Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome once again to the program that helps you learn American English. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. We have two interesting stories for you today. We will present them with words that are easy to understand, and we will slow them down so you can follow along more easily. First, we will hear about a young American who started her own business making food to sell. But she likes to think of herself as an artist. We'll have details. Then, news about the most influential people in the world. Time magazine recently named them. We'll talk about some of the people who have great influence over world events. Now it's time to go to work. Here is part one. Marcia James takes us into the kitchen.
Like many people, Bree Britt once dreamed of starting her own business. But unlike many people, the 16-year-old American did not wait until she grew up to become an entrepreneur. With a sense of purpose, a plan of action, and the help of her mother, she opened Bree's Sweet Treats in Accokeek, Maryland. For Bree Britt, nothing is more enjoyable, satisfying, and calming than preparing food in the kitchen.
I can be in the worst of moods, and once I get started baking, it's just something turns on where I'm just in my whole another world, and I'm just calm.
Being a baker is like being an artist. The food has to be cooked just right. She says baking enables her to be innovative and creative.
I'd like to compare myself to an artist or a painter for his canvas. I'm the baker, so of course my cupcakes and cookies and all my sweet desserts are my canvas.
Bree Britt started cooking with her great-grandmother when she was 5 years old.
I can remember numerous of times where I went to my grandmother's house and one of our favorite activities was baking together. She would show me how to do it to the point where when I turned 6, I was doing most of it on my own with the exception of putting it in the oven and taking it out.
A short time later, Bree perfected her great-grandmother's step-by-step directions. She then started to create her own recipes. When she was 12, Bree told her mother she wanted to open a bakery.
She told me to really think about, you know, the sacrifices and the things that I would have to go through. You know, I wasn't going to be just a normal teenager or a normal kid anymore. So she told me to really think about it.
Charmaine Britt is Bree's mother. She told Bree to sell her baked goods online first to see if her daughter was serious.
I thought it was going to be fly by night, something that she just would get tired of eventually once she saw how much work it would be. So my deal was, we'll start online, you can bake and I'll deliver on weekends.
The baked goods made enough money through internet sales that Charmaine Britt became her daughter's business partner. They signed a rental agreement for office space and opened Bree's Sweet Treats. Charmaine is responsible for the store during the day until Bree gets out of school. Leo Harrington owns a nearby barber shop. He comes to the store almost every day. He likes the choice of baked goods.
The flavor, she has all great assortment.
Leo Harrington also says he respects what Bree has done.
I watch her diligence school and then here, baking all evening, getting ready for the next day.
Going to school is not easy when operating a business. However, Bree says doing both taught her how to make good decisions about how she spends her time.
It has also taught me hard work and responsibility, and it has also taught me to be more aware of people and when they come into the store, more friendly, as I can say. It's taught me a lot.
Whether it is vanilla or chocolate, key lime or other fruit flavors, there is a secret behind Bree's recipes.
Her cupcakes are flavored with fresh fruits or more of the extracts, more so than the sugar.
Sugar or no sugar, Bree's treats are sweet enough to keep them coming back for more. I'm Marcia James.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Time magazine has released a list of 100 individuals, it says, are the most influential people in the world. These men and women come from a number of different countries. They are government leaders, activists, artists, and celebrities. The list includes U.S. President Barack Obama, Cuban leader Raúl Castro, and Pope Francis, the head of the Roman Catholic Church. Nancy Gibbs is the managing editor of Time magazine. She says she wants people to understand that just because people have power does not mean they have influence.
Power's reach is limited to those you can control. Influence's reach is boundless when any great idea, any cause or cure or creation can be shared instantly and globally from the palm of your hand.
Nigerian activist Obageli Ezekwesili is on the list. She leads the Bring Back Our Girls movement. She believes being on the list will help in finding the more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped last year by the militant group Boko Haram.
It certainly helps to keep the world constantly reminded that the girls are not yet back. A year ago, nearly everyone around the world knew that 219 young women had been abducted by savages. Suddenly, the whole world sort of moved on to other matters. With this attention on their matter, the whole world can galvanize itself again toward their rescue.
Time magazine put Abu Bakr Shekau on its list of most influential people. He is the leader of Boko Haram, which recently said it is allied with the Islamic State group. Others on the list are fighting for social justice. They include those who fight for transgender equality, protecting individuals who believe that their sex at birth is in conflict with their true gender. The list also includes those who work to empower females and defend poor people. Brian Stevenson created the Equal Justice Initiative. He fights racial discrimination and speaks up in support of prisoners in the United States. He says famous people have a responsibility to talk about important issues.
There's no question that the history of this country has been shaped by artists and entertainers and celebrities who took a stand on important social justice issues, and I think this generation needs to do the same.
You are listening to As It Is, from the Learning English Department of the Voice of America. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. This week, we have a longer report, so we will present it in two parts. Here's part one. Ghana's official national language is English, but for most citizens, English is also a second language. Until recently, children in the country had to learn English as soon as they entered school, but many had little contact with English, especially those in poor rural areas. As a result, many Ghanaian children never learned to read and write. The National Literacy Acceleration Program, NALAP, was designed to help deal with this problem. The countrywide program opened in 2010. It teaches reading and writing in local languages during a 2-year kindergarten program and during grades 1 through 3. Then, in grade 4, children begin to study in English only. Sifalaba is a rare language with about 7,000 speakers in several towns in northern Ghana. It is mainly a spoken language. Among Sifalaba speakers, the literacy rate in English is only 8%. Public school teachers in northern Ghana teach reading and writing in English and Gonja, one of the more common native languages in the area. Sifalaba had no written form until 2003. A research team of Ghanaian and American educators are working to change that.
Paul Schaefer grew up in Ghana and works for the Christian-based non-governmental organization GILLBT. That stands for Ghana Institute of Linguistics, Literacy, and Bible Translation. Beginning in 1998, he and his wife, Jennifer Schaefer, studied the Sifalaba language. They worked together with Sifalaba speakers to develop a way to write the language. They use this written language in adult literacy programs and published short books for the students to read. Edie Bayaya is the main Sifalaba literacy teacher. He is a farmer who had a few years of primary school education. Mr. Bayaya attended government-supported classes in Gonja and learned to be a literacy facilitator in that language. Since 2009, Mr. Bayaya has taught a nightly literacy class in his northern Ghanaian hometown, Mandari. He trained several other people to teach Sifalaba literacy in Mandari. Then he began literacy classes in 2 other Sifalaba-speaking villages.
Soon, children started coming to the adult classes. The young people learned the written language quickly. Paul Schaefer says the classes helped people learn the many ways written language could help them. He says they also learned that children who learn to read and write in their own language can use those skills in a second language and do better in school. This is the end of the first part of this week's Education Report. See our website, learningenglish.voanews.com, after Friday, May 1st, for the whole story and a video. Or just tune in to next week's Education Report to hear the rest of the story.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Bob Doty with Steve Ember. This week in our series, we continue the story of the administration of Herbert Hoover, and we talk about the election of 1932. ¶¶
President Herbert Hoover worked hard to rescue the American economy following the crash of the stock market. It happened in October of 1929. Within a month, Hoover called the nation's business leaders to the White House. "Don't lower wages," the president told them. Hoover called on the bankers at the Federal Reserve to make it easier for businesses to borrow money. He tried to provide funds to help farmers get fair prices for their crops. He pushed Congress to lower personal taxes. And above all, the president urged Americans not to lose hope in their economy or in themselves.
But the economy was in ruins, falling faster with each passing day of the crisis that grew into the Great Depression. The value of stocks had collapsed. Millions of workers lost their jobs. The level of industrial production in the country was less than half of what it had been before the stock market crash. Hoover's efforts were not enough to stop the growing crisis. In ever greater numbers, people called on the president to increase federal spending and provide jobs for people out of work. But the president was a conservative Republican. He did not think it was the responsibility of the federal government to provide relief for poor Americans. And he thought it was wrong to increase spending above the amount of money that the government received in taxes.
The situation seemed out of control. The nation's government and business leaders appeared to have no idea how to save the dollar and put people back to work. Hoover was willing to take steps like spending government money to help farmers buy seeds and fertilizer. But he was not willing to give wheat to unemployed workers who were hungry. He created an emergency committee to study the unemployment problem. But he would not launch government programs to create jobs. Hoover called on Americans to help their friends in need. But he resisted calls to spend federal funds for major relief programs to help the millions of Americans facing disaster.
Leaders of the Democratic Party made the most of the situation. They accused the president of not caring about the common man. They said Hoover was willing to spend money to feed starving cattle for businessmen, but not willing to feed poor children. Hoover tried to show the nation that he was dealing with the crisis. He worked with Congress to try to save the banks and to keep the dollar tied to the value of gold. He tried hard to balance the federal budget, and he told Americans that it was not the responsibility of the national government to solve all their problems.
Late in 1931, President Hoover appointed a new committee on unemployment. He named Walter Gifford to head this committee. Gifford was chief of a big company, American Telephone and Telegraph. But Gifford did Hoover more harm than good. When he appeared before Congress, Gifford was unable to defend Hoover's position that relief was the responsibility of local governments and private giving. He admitted that he did not know how many people were out of work. he did not know how many of them needed help, or how much help they needed, or how much money local governments could raise.
The situation grew worse. Some Americans began to completely lose faith in their government. They looked to groups with extreme political ideas to provide answers. Some Americans joined the Communist Party. Others helped elect state leaders with extreme political ideas. And in growing numbers, people began to turn to hatred and violence. However, most Americans remained loyal to traditional values, even as conditions grew steadily worse. They looked ahead to 1932, when they would have a chance to vote for a new president.
Leaders of the Democratic Party felt they had an excellent chance to capture the White House in the election, and their hopes increased when the Republicans renominated President Hoover and Vice President Charles Curtis in the summer of 1932. For this reason, competition was fierce for the Democratic presidential nomination. The top candidate was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the governor of New York State. Roosevelt had been re-elected to that office by a large majority just 2 years earlier. He came from a rich and famous family, but he was seen as a friend of the common man. Roosevelt was conservative in his economic thinking, but he was a progressive in his opinion that government should be active in helping people. Roosevelt had suffered from polio and could not walk. He used a wheelchair, although it was rarely shown in news pictures.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt's two main opponents were Al Smith and John Garner. Smith had been the governor of New York before Roosevelt. Garner, a Texan, was the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Together, they hoped to block Roosevelt's nomination, and they succeeded the first three times that delegates voted at the Democratic nominating convention in Chicago. Roosevelt's chief political advisor, James Farley, worked hard to find Roosevelt the votes he needed at the convention. Finally, Farley found a solution. He made a deal with supporters of John Garner. Roosevelt would make Garner the vice presidential nominee if Garner's forces voted to make Roosevelt the presidential nominee. Garner agreed. And on the next vote, the Democratic delegates nominated Franklin Roosevelt to be their presidential candidate. Al Smith was so angry about the deal that he left Chicago without congratulating Roosevelt. Roosevelt wanted to show the nation that he was the kind of man to take action, that he had more imagination than Hoover. So he broke tradition and flew to Chicago. It was the first time a candidate had ever appeared at a convention to accept a nomination. And Roosevelt told the cheering crowd that together they would defeat Hoover.
The main issue in the campaign of 1932 was the economy. President Hoover defended his policies. Roosevelt and the Democrats attacked the administration for not taking enough action. Roosevelt knew that most Americans were unhappy with the Hoover administration. So his plan during the campaign was to let Hoover defeat himself. He avoided saying anything that might make groups of voters think he was too extreme. But Roosevelt did make clear that he would move the federal government into action to help people suffering from the economic crisis. He said he was for a balanced federal budget, but he also said the government must be willing to spend extra money to prevent people from starving.
Americans liked what they heard from Franklin Roosevelt. He seemed strong. He enjoyed life. And Roosevelt seemed willing to try new ideas, to experiment with government. Hoover attacked Roosevelt bitterly during the campaign. He warned that Roosevelt and the Democrats would destroy the American system. But Americans were tired of Hoover. They thought he was too serious, too afraid of change, too friendly with business leaders instead of the working man. Most of all, they blamed Hoover for the hard times of the Depression. On Election Day, Americans voted in huge numbers for Franklin Roosevelt and the Democrats. Roosevelt won 42 of the 48 states at that time. The Democrats also gained a large majority in both houses of Congress.
The election ended 12 years of Republican rule in the White House. It also marked the passing of a long conservative period in American political life. Franklin Delano Roosevelt would become one of the strongest and most progressive presidents in the nation's history. He would serve longer than any other president, changing the face of America's political and economic systems. In our next program, we take a look at the beginning of his administration.
It's a big holiday everywhere, for the Jones family has a brand new heir. He's the joy heaven sent, and they proudly present Mr. Franklin D. Roosevelt Jones. When he grows up, he never will stray. With a name like the one that he's got today, as he walks down the street, folks will say, "Pleased to meet Mr. Franklin D. Roosevelt Jones."
Our program was written by David Jarmel. I'm Bob Doty with Steve Ember. You can find our series online with pictures, transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow our series on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.
Yes, sirree. Yes, sirree.